Live from NPR World Headquarters in Washington, D.C., this is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. I'm in the nation's capital today working on a project with NPR and other member stations, and we're broadcasting from their amazing new studios. It's actually the old Talk of the Nation studio, which is appropriate for us because we modeled our program after that classic NPR show. The rest of our regular wheelhouse gang is back in Hartford, led, of course, by Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show, Mark Pasniokas, he's Capital Bureau Chief of the Connecticut Mirror, and Christine Stewart, editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Coming up later in the show, we'll talk with them about how one candidate has successfully petitioned his way onto the ballot in the race for governor, and it is not the guy we thought would be there. As always, you can join us at 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. In just a minute, we'll bring in a special guest here in D.C. to give us some national political perspective on Connecticut politics. But first, I want to bring in WNPR's Jeff Cohen, who covers health and healthcare, for a partnership between WNPR, NPR, and Kaiser Health News. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Hi, John.
So, Jeff, we learned this week that the CEO of Access Health CT, the state's health insurance marketplace, Kevin Counihan, is leaving to take a job with the feds.
That's right. He announced yesterday, actually, the Secretary of Health and Human Services announced yesterday that she has tapped Counihan to be the new head of healthcare.gov. He says it's a job that he didn't apply for, that he was recruited for. And he'll be going from friendly Democratic-led Connecticut and democratically and Obamacare-supportive Connecticut to a much different federal landscape where he'll be running a website that manages the exchanges for 36 states. He'll be in charge, some of them openly hostile to the Affordable Care Act. He'll be managing a lot of the relationships with state-based exchanges. So it's going to be an interesting transition to watch.
The rollout of Access Health CT, of course, had its problems, but not nearly as bad as other states. Connecticut's program actually has been picked up by Maryland. It's seen as a success story, right?
It is, and the best way to look at it is by their own numbers, presumably, right? If the goal of the Affordable Care Act, if there were a couple of goals, one was to make insurance more affordable on the private market for people who otherwise couldn't get insurance, and if the other goal is to bring more insurance to people who didn't have it before, well, if we're able to break out that number, Connecticut says that half of its new enrollees, of about 250,000 people, half of them didn't have insurance before. That's a pretty – if that number holds, that's a good number for the state to hold out there and say that it succeeded with. Now, it also didn't have terribly many problems with its back-end technology. It did all right. It came a little late to the game with a Spanish language website, but that eventually was up. But its technology was successful enough that other people who were wildly unsuccessful, other states, have looked to Connecticut essentially to contract out their own technology.
Aside from these good numbers and some of that success you just talked about, Counihan caught the attention of President Obama about a year ago. How do you do that?
That's right. Well, they were doing some outreach in Connecticut. One of the places they were doing it was at a concert. They were going to concerts to try and reach young, uninsured people. And I actually went with Kevin to a Lil Wayne and T.I. concert here in Hartford. We each got our pictures taken with a big backdrop of Lil Wayne, which is a picture that's on my desk. I'm pretty happy about that.
Pretty proud of this one.
I love it. And then I spoke with Kevin about it. And that's how we got on the president's radar, and here's what Kevin had to say about it.
And he said, Lil Wayne, I've never been to a Lil Wayne concert. And I said, well, Mr. President, neither have I, and I don't think I'm exactly in the target demographic, but I got my picture taken. And he said, that's fantastic. He said, would you send it to me? And I said, our daughter has promised that it will never see the light of day.
And the back end of that story is also that his another state-based exchange person had coasters made like for drinks, and they were marketing this at bars and handing these coasters out, but she didn't want to go to the bars. She felt she was too old or too embarrassed, and the president apparently said something to the along the lines of, well, if Counihan can go to a Lil Wayne concert, you can go to a bar to check out how your coasters are doing.
My goodness. So I'm going to give you a little bit of credit for this, Jeff.
I'll take
it. I'm sure the president heard your story and thought, this is the guy. So how does all the success at the state level translate nationwide, do you think?
Well, that's the question, right? How well will his experience here in Connecticut and previously in Massachusetts and with insurers before that translate into this complex political world where both the product and the politics are really polarized? Here's what he had to say about how that transition he hopes will go.
I fundamentally think, and this may be naive, but I'm fundamentally very optimistic that people really want to do the right thing. and that people understand intuitively that having people uninsured is not right for them or right for the country. Now, how we go about doing it, people can debate, and there can be solid policy differences. But I'm fundamentally very optimistic that even though there are some big ideological schisms, that those can be bridged.
That's Kevin Counihan, who's leaving Connecticut's healthcare exchange to take a new federal job running the new or running the old healthcare.gov website. I want to bring in here in Washington, Charlie Mattesian, who's NPR's politics editor from the Washington desk. Charlie, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
So is Kevin Counihan naive in his thinking about how people are going to react to Obamacare year two?
Not naive, but I would say he has to prepare for a very tough transition and one that will be very unfamiliar to him. I mean, the environment that he's leaving in Connecticut looks nothing like what whole encounter in Washington. This is an incredibly politically fraught issue. There are lots of Democrats in Congress who will follow this very closely because they understand the ramifications of this and they understand the ripples of this across election cycles. And I think he's also going to have to contend with the idea that, you know, this is – he now will own – in many ways, the signature accomplishment of the administration, and he will be the keeper of a key part of the president's legacy. So all of that adds a layer of burden that goes on top of the operational responsibilities that he has, and that's something I think that is going to be a big ramp up for him.
But this is a different sort of gig than the Kathleen Sebelius gig, getting it all started and having to go through the awful problems that it had, both politically and then also technologically. He's essentially now going to be running something that has been more successful over time. And despite still political opposition in many states, the fact of the matter is it's working in Connecticut and other places. It's getting people insured. Maybe he's got a slightly different gig than the folks who had to start the thing.
Right, but it's still a politically toxic in lots of ways, and not just on the Republican side with Republicans. Now, if you follow the national debate on Obamacare, it's actually sort of waned as an issue in this election cycle in a way that a lot of people wouldn't have expected earlier this year. But at the same time, it is still very much a part of state legislative elections, gubernatorial elections, because so many exchanges ended up in disaster. And in Washington, the debate is still not resolved. I mean, we still have the second round to come up. And so there's still a lot out there and a lot that can go wrong and a lot of landmines that are out there that he's going to have to sidestep.
This is Where We Live. It's The Wheelhouse today, and we're talking with Charlie Mattesian. He's NPR's politics editor at the Washington desk. Also in studio with us is Jeff Cohen. He's WNPR reporter covering health and healthcare. I'm actually broadcasting from NPR headquarters in Washington today. The rest of our panel will join us in just a minute. Charlie, I'd like to actually switch gears a little bit and talk about how the Obama administration, how Washington largely perceives what's going on in Connecticut. This is one example of Washington turning to Connecticut. Another, Gina McCarthy, the EPA administrator, came from Connecticut. It seems as though a little bit of a good relationship has been formed between now Governor Daniel Malloy and the president. How do you think the president views some of the things that are going on in our little state?
Well, obviously, the president smiles on Connecticut, a blue state, in a way that Republicans in Washington do not. I think, you know, there is some goodwill. You can see that from on all sorts of different levels, whether it's the Democratic Governors Association pouring cash into that race or Vice President Biden visiting the state. On the other hand, though, Republicans in this town almost look at Connecticut as a lost cause. You see the Republican Governors Association would love to take down Governor Malloy this year. I think in many ways, when Republicans look from Washington, then they look to the Northeast. It's almost a non-entity. Even the Republican members of other Northeastern states are looked on askance from the Republican majority in the House, at least, as almost a different part of the country with an entirely different set of unfamiliar values. So there's a huge gap in this city in terms of how Connecticut is perceived by the two parties.
Colin, I'd like you to maybe jump in with some of the crew there and talk a little bit more about this. I mean, we focus so much on Governor Malloy, his reelection efforts, and the things that we see that either work or don't work in Connecticut. But viewed from a national lens, you take a look at how people in Washington are viewing the things coming out of Connecticut, and it seems like a much rosier picture.
Well, I think you can start with Obamacare. You know, Obamacare, in some ways, politically, nationally, is a little bit like root canal, which is to say if they called it something else, probably people wouldn't be as appalled by it. So if you look at the way in which Obamacare is perceived and how it polls much lower than its individual elements. In other words, if you poll people, and I think Kaiser did this recently, if you poll people individually on all the things that Obamacare does, except for the individual mandate, which never polls well, people like Obamacare. They just don't know that it's Obamacare. They don't know that those are the things that are in Obamacare. One of the things Cunahan did really well was communicate with people. I mean, I don't even know if he did it really well, but he did it better than most people do. You know, even just that whole idea of getting out into bars, getting out into Lil Wayne concerts, although he appeared not to know the difference between TI and IT, but that's another story. But, but you know, getting out there and actually sort of talking to people, interacting with people, doing that kind of basic grassroots work that you need to do to introduce somebody, some people to a very complex new program. It's really a great example of how government should work, particularly during the rollout of something that's pretty complicated and that people have their antennae up about. So, I mean, that is an example of Connecticut doing something well. I don't know. Christine, do you have another example of or another answer to Mr. Dankosky's question?
No, I think that Kevin Cunahan has done a fantastic job in Connecticut. He has communicated. I don't know if there's a reporter in the state who doesn't have Kevin Cunahan's cell phone number. There's probably a bunch of consumers in the state who have Kevin Cunahan's cell phone number, which I don't know what that means when he goes to Washington, how many people he can actually personally reach out to and personally touch and personally communicate. I think that he's going to struggle in doing that.
And Paz, you know, this is something that Governor Malloy has really tried to do, too, right? He's tried to give himself and his accomplishments a national platform in addition to his state profile.
Absolutely. Governor Malloy has embraced President Obama, even as the president's approval ratings have dipped, even in Connecticut. In addition to Obamacare, the governor decided he would be the first governor to deliver a state law mandating a 10-10 minimum wage, which, of course, was one of the benchmarks set by the president. And there's no way the president is going to achieve that federally. So time and again, the governor has tried to put Connecticut out front on some of these national democratic goals. The state also is the only state to adopt a state law mandating that certain private employers have paid sick days. So the governor has embraced, you know, much of the president's agenda at some political risk, even in this state.
John, back to you.
Well, and I'm wondering if before we turn to other issues, if maybe we're making too big a connection between this. I mean, Paz, is the governor going to get credit for Connecticut's health exchange doing a really good job? I mean, is Kevin Cunahan really seen across the state, people who are going to vote in this November's election, as an agent of the governor?
No. You know, I think it's removed a liability that, as Charlie said, you see in some other states. I think you probably can make the case that it's neutralized it as an issue here. You know, in some circles, it's a positive talking point. But to your basic point, yeah, I don't think the average voter is saying, you know, whoopee, we didn't screw up.
Well, Charlie, I want to turn back to you and just ask about the way Governor Malloy is perceived on the national stage. We kind of joke with him about whether or not he has a national political future. A lot of governors do what he has done, try to raise the national profile. He goes on national talk shows on MSNBC all the time. He mixes it up with Bobby Jindal. He mixes it up with Chris Christie. Is he someone who you think has some sort of a future either in Washington in an Obama or a Hillary Clinton administration, or someone who actually might run for president someday?
Well, I guess it depends on how you define a future in national politics. I mean, if on the one hand, he certainly will be a prominent national voice. You've seen that from his national appearances, his appearances at various press conferences, his TV appearances, the high profile he's taking on a lot of issues of concern on the left. But having said that, he lacks some of the elements that take you to the next step in national politics. He's not charming enough. You know, the agenda that he's pursued in Connecticut really isn't going to play well in large swaths of this country. And it's hard to see where he's going to have the kind of appeal that you'd need to be a viable candidate, whether it's vice presidential or even to run in a presidential campaign and be successful across the expanse of 50 states.
Colin, do you think that he has some of these ambitions, though? I mean, I think we have often made a case
that charm is not something that he is very long in. But indeed, he seems to have a vision of himself beyond what he is doing right now. Do you think that there's a chance that Governor Malloy is working toward a larger political goal here?
First of all, I can't believe Charlie just said that. Charlie, if you would just take some time to get to know this man. Well, look, I mean, look, everybody, every satrap, everybody running any kind of governmental operation anywhere thinks he's ready for the next step. I mean, it would be easier to compile a list of mayors and governors who don't think they're ready to go to the next level than it would be to compile the list of those who do. They all think that. And so, yes, he's had some successes here. He's made some of the right moves. He's allied himself very prominently with Obama. He's been kind of the hockey goon ready to go out on the ice and duke it out with Bobby Jindal on appropriate occasions. But, I mean, the thing is, the hockey goon doesn't usually wind up on the all-star team. You know, the hockey goon often has, like, a very specific role, which is to go out there and punch somebody. Nobody's expecting him to score a whole lot of goals. And so, you know, the charm thing, it's significant. People tend to vote for people they like. In Connecticut, they happen to not have that option. But you know, as you move to the national stage, I mean, you know, think of the consummate national politician of our generation was Bill Clinton, who was really, really good at connecting with people, at persuading people that he felt their pain, and making people believe that he was essentially a very, very likable, connectable guy.
I think it's time to remind John Dankosky that the governor's reelect number, when last we checked, was 44%, which is not the best springboard for national office.
I think that that's fair to say. We'll be talking about those scintillating debates between him and Tom Foley coming up in just a little bit, and also whether or not any third-party challengers are going to mess up anything for either Governor Malloy or Tom Foley. But before we turn to our next break and our next topic, I actually want to talk with Charlie Mattesian a little bit about another Connecticut political issue. The 5th District in Connecticut has long been one of the more hotly contested Northeast districts. Elizabeth Esty, now a freshman congresswoman, is running up against Mark Greenberg, who's running for like the 50th time in a row. It seems clear as though Mark Greenberg's going to spend a lot of his own money. It seems clear that there's going to be some Republican money coming into this. Do you think that there's any chance that the Republicans actually are going to put enough effort into this to unseat Elizabeth Esty coming up this fall?
Well, I think hotly contested Northeast race is something of an oxymoron the way politics operates now. But having said that, you know, if you take a look at the orbit of the universe of competitive elections in the House this year, it's really not that big. It's a race that is on the national radar for national Republicans, but it's really not a top-tier race in lots of reasons. And, you know, the reason that national Republicans look at this race is for a number of points. Obviously, freshmen are the most vulnerable of the species. If you're going to take out a member of Congress, the best time to do it is on their first reelect. The district obviously has a little bit of a GOP heritage. You know, the 2012 result, when you take a look at those numbers, kind of disappointing. Presidential year with a little tailwind from Obama. Elizabeth Esty still fell short of 50%. So, you know, those are reasons for Republicans to get a little excited and to keep an eye on it from Washington. But having said that, you know, Connecticut's still a blue state. I think there's a perception among national Republicans at the committee here that maybe Greenberg's not the greatest fit for that district. And, you know, maybe that's the district that doesn't have a you know, great affinity for a doctrinaire conservative. And I think on the other side of it, Esty has proved to be a pretty good fundraiser. And that is something that goes very far in the city when the parties are thinking about their resource allocations and how they pay attention to races. They want to see, you know, do you make your calls? Do you raise your money? Are you staying out of trouble? Are there any silver bullet issues in the race? And you don't see those right now. So it's something that I think it will be on the radar, but right now it's not a top-tier race.
Esty released her first TV spot this week. She doesn't do any talking other than the required disclaimer at the end, and it features a veteran that she helped. Let's listen.
Elizabeth Esty cut through the red tape and fixed the problem. Elizabeth got things done, and she got it done quick. She cares a lot about veterans, and she makes you feel like you're part of her family. I don't know where I'd be without her.
And that's a new Elizabeth Esty ad. Colin McEnroe, your thoughts on Elizabeth Esty remaking herself here as someone who's going to help her constituents. It's not really a race, near as I can tell, about any big issues whatsoever. And I know Mark Greenberg's talking about things like her support of Obamacare. I don't know if any of this plays. What are your thoughts?
Well, see my comments above about the fact that people tend to vote for people that they like, and in Connecticut they appear not to have that right. I mean, this is also a race in which there is not a warm and fuzzy candidate. And just to sharpen the point of what Charlie said before, and I think he's right on track there, I think the Republican Party nationally, I would be surprised if they weren't kind of disappointed in the performance of the state Republican Party in developing good, viable candidates. And this is a pretty tippy district. It's really not like the rest of Connecticut. It has a very bizarre and checkered history, and it hasn't always existed kind of the way it exists now. But it's a tippy district. It really can be won by Republicans. It has been won by Republicans. But it gets won by a certain kind of Republican, and you really need to develop the right candidate there. Instead, Mark Greenberg is running for a second or third, I've lost track, time, more or less by default. You know, he's got money, he's got ambition. Most of the other people who are a little bit more centrist and possibly a little bit more viable are either just not running, or they're judges, or I don't know what happened to them all. But if you're the national party, I think maybe you're looking at this race and going, wow, we really could have done a little bit better, but I don't know if Greenberg is the guy. Yeah, Christine.
I think they had a candidate. They had Andrew Rohrabach, and what happened was that Governor Malloy appointed him to the bench. So I forget what the margin in that race was, but it was pretty small, and Andrew Rohrabach was definitely the type of Republican that could have won in that district.
Yeah, pass.
Well, and also, I think all the candidates from 2 years ago are going to be busy being witnesses in John Rowland's trial. And so that would be a distraction.
That's a one-day
well.
Commitment.
Mark Bazniokas is Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Christine Stewart is the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Colin McEnroe is the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thanks very much to Jeff Cohen, WNPR's healthcare reporter, for giving us the latest on Kevin Counihan. And thanks also to Charlie Mattesian. He's NPR's politics editor. Thanks so much for coming in, Charlie. I appreciate it.
It was a great time. Thank you.
I'm John Dankosky. I'm broadcasting live from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. Colin is back at the controls in Hartford. When we come back, we'll be talking more about the governor's race, including a third-party candidate who's going to be in the race, and it's not the guy you thought. You can join the conversation Where We Live right after this break. Live from NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C., this is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. It's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. I'm here on assignment from NPR, working on a project with member stations and National Public Radio. I'm broadcasting today from the old Talk of the Nation studio, which is, of course, very appropriate, very important to us. We modeled our program on that classic NPR show that our very good friend Libby Kahn Franklin once worked on. So I'm happy to be back in that seat. Back in Hartford today with us is Colin McEnroe, of course, of the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What's on your show today, Colin?
Oh, don't ask.
Come on.
Well, no, it's
I really want to know
it's
now.
It's a show we're about a book called XL Love by actually a very distinguished journalist whom I think you know quite well, John. But this is about the whole question of in the throes of America's rising obesity epidemic, is that affecting people's sexual relations? It's hard to talk about this show without sounding like Maury Povich. but I think if you sound like Maury Povich once a year, that's okay.
I will say this. When this book came in from Sarah Varney, who's a great healthcare reporter, I looked at it and said, Sarah Varney, oh, she's great. I'd love to do this on the show. And then I read what it's about, and I said, that's a perfect show for Colin McEnroe.
Right.
Thank you for taking that off our hands, Colin. Also joining us in the studio is Christine Stewart. She's the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. And Mark Pazniokas, he's Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. All right, so let's get to the governor's race. Jonathan Pelto, of course, was expected to be the third-party candidate who is going to disrupt things, who is going to take votes away from Governor Daniel Malloy. Well, Jonathan Pelto stopped by Colin McEnroe's show on Monday. Here's a little bit of what he said.
The legal, structural, and political barriers were, quite frankly, greater than I had expected. I take full responsibility for not collecting enough, for having a campaign that didn't collect enough signatures. But we've really learned a lot about how dysfunctional, how primitive the process is, and how the quote-unquote incumbency party, whether it's Democrat, Republican, the establishment, the insiders, have set up basically a system that is almost impossible to qualify for the ballot. That said, hats off to Joe Visconti, who did do a remarkable job.
So that's Jonathan Pelto talking on your show, Colin, essentially telling the world he's not going to be on the November ballot. That's about as sad a soundbite as you can possibly hear.
Well, you know, what's sadder still, and this is further proof that I'm not a very good journalist, is that later in the week, I think it was Keith Faniff, Mark's colleague, who actually asked Jonathan the question I should have asked, which is how many signatures did you turn in?
And that was me.
That was you. That was you. Okay. I knew it was some really smart journalist.
Yeah,
anyway.
Yeah.
So, and it turns out it was like 4,000, which is, you know, I mean, he didn't.
Oh, for the love of God.
It's like getting really mad at the teacher because she's being unfair to some kid in your class and then finding out he only turned in half of his homework in the first place. So, I mean, what Jonathan was counting on apparently was this invisible, uncounted army that he kind of putatively knew about and had that was also helping him. So, I mean, I think in a way, I've in the space of a day or so gone from thinking that Jonathan is everything that he just said he was, a really good stalking horse for this question of, is this process unfair? Is it twisted? Is it distorted? Does it need to be changed? By the way, I think all those things are true. I think it is an unfair process that is twisted and distorted and needs to be changed. But he's not as good a poster boy for it as I thought he was because you really do at least have to turn in, say, 7,501 signatures and then get mad because they disqualified two of them. You can't turn in 4,000 signatures, Christine, and then get really upset.
Well, I mean, that's what he's been saying since the beginning, that he turned in 5,000 signatures, and he expected that these 1,500 signatures were going to materialize from this army of volunteers.
2,500. We'll get emails about your math.
Oh, okay.
Okay,
well, okay, so 4,000, then 2,500, but I thought he told me 5,000, but whatever.
He's been, I think, a little bit all over the place on what he turned in, he said.
Yeah, and I mean, keeping track of that, and actually what Joe Visconti did was that he had training sessions where he trained the volunteers who went out how to gather the signatures, what they were looking for, what they needed to make sure that they would have enough. And
he had a petition range, I think, that he took them to and had them,
had them shoot down those signatures. Yeah. But I think he smartly stood outside the places where they were having these ballot referendums, you know, either for town budgets or for special elections, and gathered signatures of voters coming out of the polling place so you knew these people were registered to vote.
And he also was armed when he was asking them for their signatures, so I think he got a good response. Yeah.
He had beach balls, too.
But very, very quickly, I mean, what does any of this say about the actual influence that John Pelto could have had on this campaign if indeed he'd gotten those signatures? Because, well, yes, clearly he didn't have a very well-organized political machine to go out and get the signatures, but as Colin suggested, he feels as though there's this shadow army of tens of thousands of people who would vote for him as opposed to Governor Malloy. Should we now look at all this, Paz, and say, well, you know, maybe there just aren't that many votes out there at all voting for anybody other than Dan Malloy on the Democratic side?
I'd be careful in overreaching and what this means and what it doesn't mean. Pelto's absence from, you know, debate stages is a great boon for the governor because he was going to be trying to chip away at the governor's base. He was going to be trying to chip away on the governor's refusal to raise tax rates at the highest end, and obviously on the education issue that's been Jonathan's hallmark. But to use this as a yardstick on voter anger and voter disaffection with Dan Malloy as opposed to Jonathan's inability to put together a decent petition operation, boy, that's a hard one.
Yeah, I think that's really true. That this is – it raises bigger questions about how serious Jonathan ever was about this because, as we've been saying straight along, one of the things that you have to accept, it's sort of a law of political life. If there's a structural impediment to your candidacy, then you have to bend all of your efforts to dealing with that structural impediment until you solved it, and then you can talk about other stuff. So if you visited Jonathan's website, which first of all, 2004 call, they want it back. But if you visited Jonathan's website, you just didn't get that. In other words, you might even see a freshly posted Jonathan Pelto essay about education policy. This is not a time to be talking about education policy. Every search engine query about Jonathan Pelto and every visit to his website should have returned a lot of information about who was going to be where with petitions, who was going to be standing outside Big Y in Barkhamsted, and also how to do your own petition. It is possible to do it. It's not the easiest thing in the world, but how to do that too. And until he solved that problem, there shouldn't have been a peep out of Jonathan about anything else. And it does raise questions about, you know, whether he really had his eyes on the prize.
I'm wondering, Christine, quickly, if you feel like this actually had a different unintended consequence. Governor Malloy had to go out to all of the unions, the teachers' unions included, and make a case for why they really should get back behind him once again. Now, it was pretty clear the major unions weren't going to go anyplace else other than with Governor Malloy. But did any of this John Pelto meddling in this campaign, as the Malloy folks saw it, did it mobilize any union support behind Governor Malloy and truly against Tom Foley, the guy they don't want running the state?
You know, that's a good question. I think that Jonathan was not invited to some of these union confabs. I think the only one he was invited to offer his take on was AFSCME counsel for allowed him to speak to the group before before they voted and did their endorsement of Governor Malloy, which was inevitable. So I think that he's added to the debate and you know, talking about education reform, but I don't know how much of that really impacted the union support of Malloy.
Governor Malloy had a serious problem with the teachers, with or without Jonathan Pelto. And there had been behind-the-scenes talks for a while by union people trying to get the governor to step away from Stephen Pryor. He did so in kind of a, you know, interesting way. He didn't fire his commissioner of education, but he made clear that the commissioner is not coming back if there is a second term. So he sort of had it both ways. And then, you know, on the same day that he sort of took questions about Pryor's departure, the governor appointed a teacher union leader to the State Board of Education, filling one of the vacancies that had been left by somebody who helped run a charter school, which the teacher unions hate. So, you know, there was a lot going on here. They knew they've had trouble with the teachers unions ever since, you know, he made that ill-fated remark that all you got to do is show up to get tenure.
I want to move on to the candidate who is actually going to be on the ballot. We didn't think Joe Visconti was going to really have a huge impact on this campaign, but now it seems he will be on the November ballot. And now the activist, the gun rights activist, the Tea Party organizer, actually has a TV ad. Let's listen.
I'm Joe Visconti, and I'm running for governor of Connecticut because the Second Amendment has been violated by Connecticut Governor Dan Malloy. Please support my campaign today at viscontiforgovernor.com. And join me in the fight for the right to bear arms in the Constitution state.
Remember, what one day is your neighbor's problem can easily become yours. I'm Joe Visconti, and I approve this message.
Colin, you know, I can't see it because it's radio, but boy, it sure sounds like an interesting ad.
Yeah, and you really do have to see it. I mean, we do recommend that everybody watch this ad. And the ad is a perfect allegory for Joe Visconti. He's in this fabulous and outlandish-looking white car, white convertible that's just decorated with guns. The door handles are pistols. I mean, everything's sort of guns on this car. And then there's this huge, longhorn horn that's mounted on the grill of it. And it really does look like an ad that you might run very effectively in Texas, but maybe not so much in Connecticut. But it's a great allegory for Joe because he's having a really fun ride in this ad, which is entirely what he plans to do in between now and November, is have a really fun ride. He doesn't – I mean, you would never run this ad if you were going to go after Connecticut's 800,000 unaffiliated voters. Not very many of them are going to react positively, at least positively in the sense of wanting to vote for you. But if you were really interested in stirring the pot up and having some fun and calling attention to how much incredible fun it is to own a whole lot of guns, then you would run this ad.
But that ad is directed actually to people in Texas and other places like that. That's Joe's way to try to raise money from the national base of gun owners. That's, you know, he wants to have enough money to run this on the outdoor channel in other states, which you can do, you know, it doesn't take a lot of money. So that's his goal with that ad. By the way, the car is the Buckmobile. This was the car that was once owned by, I'm sure every NPR listener remembers Buck Owens from Hee Haw. But anyway, it's now owned by a Connecticut collector. Joe got his hands on it, and it's, you know, it's a fun ad. I mean, you know, this is a guy who knows media, who knows social media, and he's going to stir the pot a bit.
I think what's interesting is that Joe has the same problem with gun owners as Jonathan Pelto had with the unions. Is that, you know, Joe is getting some pushback. He's actually had to block some Second Amendment groups from his Facebook page because they are attacking him, and their support is likely to go to Tom Foley.
I mean, that is really happening now with the CCDL too. One of the big gun groups is backing Tom Foley instead of Joe Visconti.
And backing Tom Foley, despite calling the fact that Tom Foley has just continually not come out with any sort of real position on guns one way or another. Yes, it's a blue state. Yes, it's a problematic issue, certainly. But Tom Foley hasn't really done anything to court that constituency. I'm wondering if it even really matters by the numbers if he does.
Well, I mean, I think Christine's point is a really good one, and you can sort of extend it and say, you know, the lesson that Joe Visconti and John Pelto are extracting right now is that you can run an issue-based candidacy, but that won't necessarily entitle you to the electorate that embodies that issue. So, you know, all the ways that John Pelto symbolized a certain amount of discontent that might be coming from teachers' unions, Joe Visconti obviously embodies some discontent coming from gun owners, but that doesn't necessarily entitle him to the vote of every gun owner or even a major organization of gun owners.
I'm wondering, Christine and Paz, if you feel like we can handicap at all what sort of real votes impact Joe Visconti is going to have on the race. What we were talking about for months with John Pelto is he doesn't have to draw a whole bunch of votes away from Governor Malloy in order to make a difference. That last race between Tom Foley and Dan Malloy separated by some 6,000 votes in total, and there's some recounting there. Does he take any votes at all? Does he really factor in?
You know, I think if you look back at 2010, you had Tom Marsh, who was the first electman of Chester, who ran as an independent, and he took more than 17,000 votes and was completely unknown. So I think that Joe Visconti is going to take some number of votes. You know, whether it's enough to call him a spoiler, I'm not sure.
You know, Tom Foley thought that Marsh took at best 2,500 votes out of the Republican column because nobody knew who Tom Marsh
right.
was. And Marsh had the advantage of running on the independent line. And there is something about that brand that does attract, you know, certain voters. Joe's not going to have that advantage. But unlike Tom Marsh, who was not identified with any particular base of voters, you know, Visconti is reaching out to Tea Party folks. He is reaching out to gun owners. And yes, the groups are going to be with Tom Foley. But there will be an element. Now, how big that element is, who knows? But there certainly will be an element that will rally around Visconti as a true conservative as opposed to Tom Foley, who out of necessity, and that's a piece I wrote today, out of necessity is adopting a certain studied vagueness because when you run statewide as a Republican, you start with 20% of the electorate is in your party. So you do have to reach out to, you know, more than half the unaffiliateds and also kind of grab a sliver of the Democrats. So that's why you see Tom Foley be as careful and as cautious as he has been. The game is to draw as many people in without alienating, you know, your own Republican base.
I think there's another part of this, too, which is that the more that Tom Foley gets identified at all with gun issues, the more he accepts endorsements. You saw the mayor of East Hartford today saying that he'd made a pact with the devil to accept this endorsement. The more that it really allows Dan Malloy to run a little bit more on Newtown. I mean, making Newtown and Sandy Hook an electoral political issue. We've talked about this in the past. There's something a little unappetizing about it, a little unattractive. It's a tragedy, really kind of deserves to live as a tragedy, not a political issue. But to whatever degree Tom Foley can be forced into kind of embracing gun rights, it gives Dan Malloy a little bit more operating room to step in there and say, you know, we had this horrible thing happen, and I answered the bell on that. You know, I came out and said, things just can't go on like this. You know, I got legislation passed. I was there for the people down there. I think most people who don't even like Dan Malloy that much but aren't gun rights advocates would agree this was one of his finest hours, the time of Newtown and the way he kind of handled the state at that time. And a better Dan Malloy than we usually see came out. It's tough for him to run on that. But fully, if he makes the wrong moves in all the ways that Paz was just saying, can give him a little bit of room to run on that.
And that the mayor of East Hartford, Marsha LeClerc, she changed the gun issue in her remarks the other day. She wasn't content to just sort of argue it within the four corners of the gun control bill passed after Newtown. She was raising questions about what really would Tom Foley do? And she expanded the issue to the protections that women now have in domestic violence cases, where they can go to court and make sure that their estranged spouses have to give up their guns during the pendency of, you know, of a heated divorce, that kind of thing. So that was interesting. I mean, the ability to try to make the gun issue broader, to say, hey, this is about protecting women. The governor already is trying to define the gun issue as about protecting school children, naturally enough, after Newtown. So it'll be interesting to see how the gun issue evolves. Clearly, the Democrats have great plans for making it more than just banning the sale of the AR-15 and large-capacity magazines.
We're talking today in the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, with Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror, Christine Stewart, she's the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com, and Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Coming up after our break, we're going to preview the scintillating Foley-Molloy debates that are coming up. We're going to try to find out whether or not it gets beyond the studied vagueness that Paz was talking about earlier. You can, of course, join us at 860-275-7266. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I'm broadcasting live from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. We'll be right back after this break, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, what exactly are think tanks anyway? How much of an influence do they have right now in American life? We'll talk to some think tank experts who've been, well, they've been thinking about these very questions. Are think tanks actually leading some sort of intellectual charge, or are they just another vehicle for partisan politics? That's our conversation tomorrow, Where We Live. Today, it's our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, and I'm broadcasting live from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C., sitting in the very seat that Neil Conan once sat in to host the great Talk of the Nation, a program that we learned an awful lot from about how to do a talk show just like this. So I'm thrilled to be here today. Joining us from our Hartford studio, as usual, is Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Mark Pazniokas from the Connecticut Mirror, and Christine Stewart, the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. So the Norwich Bulletin's got the first gubernatorial debate tonight, Colin. What do we see? This is the big pregame show here.
Well, I mean, the big question probably is, can these debates have the effect of making these candidates more specific? Molloy can't help but be specific. He has a record that he's essentially running on. As we've been saying straight along here, and I mean, I think Paz's phrase, studied vagueness, has exactly the kind of depressing...
Looks great in a bumper sticker.
Iconic style that really will defy this campaign. Foley is a little less in that category. But Paz, one of the problems with this debate is it's kind of like a Broadway show that's opening out of town, which is to say that most people who might want to see it won't be able to.
But wait, I have breaking news.
Ah.
Or maybe. CTN just emailed me to say that now they are going to see if they can get a signal at the debate location. So stay tuned. They may show it live for those of you who are aficionados of CTN. So check their website, CTN, and we'll post it on our site.
Hold it. I just want to pass. They're trying to get a signal from the debate site. It's in Norwich, right? Not at the North Pole.
Don't.
I think that the Norwich Bulletin sometimes does these things streaming
they're
live,
not doing
too.
It live.
They're not doing it streaming live.
Norwich's plan, as announced on their website, is to show the entire video on Thursday. So it will be eventually available, but yeah, it's kind of weird in this day and age, particularly where there's a million cable access channels, that we can't see this thing live, or at least we're not 100% guaranteed of seeing it live.
But Christine, it might play a little bit into either one or both of the camps' aspirations to have one chance to debate where the whole world won't be watching.
No, I think it definitely does that. You know, sometimes these things aren't are retold better than when they actually happened. The story becomes more interesting at that point. So, you know, neither Foley or Malloy are Lincoln Douglas. So it should be interesting to see what happens.
Well, you know, John, and I think, Lydia, I think you have this ready. One of the things that we did do while you were gone, you know, we've been talking a lot about how to organize these debates and what they should be like, particularly if it just winds up, as is the case with Norwich, only with Malloy and Foley on stage. Joe Visconti was not invited, nor was Jonathan Pelto going to be able to, even had he qualified. So what we have done, John, is come up with one piece of music which we feel could thematically tie together all these Malloy and Foley debates. Go ahead, Lydia. That's my big contribution.
And Roy Ocagrosso, I believe, is playing that tape to Governor Malloy right now as a warning of what not to do.
Well, but so talk about that, Pez. I mean, what don't you want to do? We joke a lot on this show about here are two, you know, sort of archly unlikable guys who are going to snipe at each other. And so what shouldn't they be doing? Let's not talk about what they should be doing. What shouldn't they be doing during these debates?
The governor's biggest problem 4 years ago is that he came across like the former prosecutor that he is. And you could have a debate where a debate judge might, on the forensic debating points, would award you the win. But the audience can walk away thinking, I don't like this guy. And that's a big part of what debates are about, particularly once we move past the off-Broadway tryout and we get to the televised debates. These guys have got to convince voters that if you don't have reason to like them, that you can at least envision living with them for the next 4 years.
By the way, we have a tweet from Christy that's kind of apropos here. She tweets, I like the fact that Malloy is a crass man. He seems less politician slimy. You know, and
but Foley has to seem not like a pushover. I think in the last debate before the Republican primary that he wasn't aggressive enough with John McKinney, and John McKinney just clobbered him.
And I also wonder, Christine, whether in fact it works for Malloy to try to be somebody that he's not. I mean, he's essentially a pretty combative guy, and Paz is right. I mean, you want to have him dial it down a little bit. But basically, if you take the firecracker out of Malloy's hands, he doesn't have anything else. He doesn't have an olive branch that he can pick up.
But I think he proved in 2010 that he can be a nice person at the same time as he's making his point. And we didn't see that in 2006 when he was it 2006, 2008?
I was absent that day.
I had missed it in 2010 when he was a nice person. I thought the big beneficiary of the 2010 debates was Tom Marsh, because I was just sitting there going, is there anybody else I could vote for?
No, I mean, the governor, to take Christine's point seriously, when the governor is talking about Newtown, you do see a different Dan Malloy. You do see a bit of the humanity. You do see him taking an issue and connecting it to people. And that's going to be the challenge for him, is to take a breath. Yes, to be himself. You know, he can't come out and do that. You know, when he really tries to smile when it's inappropriate, it's kind of cringe-inducing. But he needs to have a more measured approach. And we don't know which Tom Foley will see, because, you know, Tom Foley was a decent debater 4 years ago against Senator McKinney in the primary. Christine is right. I mean, Christine is actually, he was generous. I mean, he wasn't low key. There were times I thought he was sleeping. And I don't think that's going to be Foley's tack against this governor. In fact, he has said he is willing and able to be very aggressive against the Democrat in a way that he had no intention of being with John McKinney. He had no desire to elevate John McKinney's profile. He wanted voters to kind of nap until August 12th, and now he has the nomination. And we'll see now what is his game for the rest of the way.
Hey, and Paz, we just have a couple of seconds here left, but you're going to be taking part in another debate coming up on September 23rd with the AARP, right?
Well, we'll see. We have heard from one of the candidates for governor, a major party candidate who has committed. We have not heard from the other, so I don't know if that debate will make the final cut. Foley and Malloy have each promised to do at least five, but I can't tell you right now if we're going to be one of the five or the six or whatever they'll be.
And I know Colin and I are working on these things as well. So we'll see whether we get involved in all of this fun that's happening around these debates. You guys sound very excited. Mark Pazniokas, Capitol Bureau Chief for the Connecticut Mirror. Christine Stewart, the editor of CTNewsJunkie.com. Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thank you all so much for joining us today. Our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse, broadcast live from NPR's headquarters in Washington, D.C. I want to thank Kara Philbin, Emily Dagger, and Brian Jarboe for all of their assistance. Thanks to everyone here at NPR. Thanks to our producers, Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer of our show is Katie Tolarski. Tomorrow, I'll be back in Hartford talking about think tanks. That's tomorrow's program, Where We Live.